out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Monday, the 24th of September, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioarian.com. Well, we're going to do something a little bit different this week. I'm actually not going to be recording any live podcast this week, so this is pre-recorded. And like we have done before, when we've had a short series, we're going to be looking at a particular subject this week. Now, I guess long-time listeners must be aware that I've spoken about how I came into nationalism and how I found a library of online books that was online. I think it was called The Great White Desert. And this collection of books, it was full of racial books written by racial authors. And a lot of them were actually written in the 19th century. There were people that were writing in 1800 and whatever. Some of them were slave owners. And these were people that were really had a good understanding, I think, of the Negro. They were very honourable people, and they weren't motivated by hate at all. They were motivated by a quest for discovery, really. I mean, these were real pioneers, and they didn't look at the Negroes as bad people. They looked at them as more of like a childlike race that needed somebody to look up to, somebody to set a good example. Even the slave owners themselves, they had very different views to the views that we are taught today. And some of the ideas that go around in nationalism, slavery was terrible because it put white people out of work. But a lot of these actual slave owners, and we're taught most of them were Jews. I know most of them were Jews that actually brought them over. But there were white slave owners, and they saw slavery. They didn't see it as putting working class whites out of work. They thought that it would mean that working class whites had time to educate themselves and better themselves and would rise in status because they didn't have to do all this work. And they saw the Negro's natural state as being in slavery, the same as the cow's natural state is grazing in a field, the pig's natural state is wallowing in muck. They saw the Negro's natural state as working for the white man. That was just his position. That was his natural position when he was domesticated. When he was in the wild, he just starves, basically, because he doesn't know how to feed himself. And one of these amazing men of the time, I think they were amazing, is a man called John H. Van Evry. And I first came across him reading a book called White Supremacy and Negro Subordination. And I've done a series of narrations from that book. In fact, it's most of the book. You can probably look it up on Archive or at Radio Arian. It was part of the Arian narration series. And we're going to be looking at John H. Van Evry this week because there is a particularly good Wikipedia article on him that will probably get removed due to this series. I'm quite surprised that it's actually up there. But it does give a very in-depth analysis of the things that John H. Van Evry was saying. And he was quite an amazing character, as we will see here. John H. Van Evry, he was born 1814 to 1896. He was an American physician and also a defender of slavery, who was best known as the editor of the Weekly Day Book, which was a newspaper at the time, and the author of several books on race and slavery, which reproduced the ideas of scientific racism for a popular audience. Now, obviously, this is written today. How can facts be racist? Facts just are what they are. the Negro does have a lower IQ than the white man. He does have a smaller size brain. He doesn't have any civilization to his name. He never invented the wheel. He never invented a seaworthy boat. I'm not even sure that he invented fire. He didn't actually come across fire until much later than anybody else. And that's not scientific racism. That's just facts. They may be uncomfortable in our politically correct society today, but back then they were just facts. He wasn't looked at as a racist. I don't think the man was a racist. I don't think he hated other races at all. He was just putting down the facts as he saw them. And he was a doctor. He was a physician. So he was reporting on the most up-to-date views of his time. He was also the proprietor of the publishing company Van Every, Horton and Company. And I do think he was a bit of a forerunner for Henry Ford. You think Henry Ford and the Dearborn Independent that he used to publish. John H. Van Every, he published this newspaper called the Weekly Daybook. He was described by the historian George M. Fredrickson as perhaps the first professional racist in American history. Well, he was a white nationalist, basically. Probably the first white nationalist in American history, because he wasn't just pointing out the differences between whites and blacks. He was also saying that all white people need to be cared for. The lower classes need to be cared for. This was a man with a deep understanding of his ethnic loyalties to other white people. So he was quite socialist in his thoughts. His thoughts, which lacked significant scientific evidence, that's what they say here, but there wasn't much evidence around at the time. He didn't have DNA testing. I think he did as best as he could with the evidence that was available. His scientific evidence emphasized the inferiority of black people to white people, defended slavery as practiced in the United States, and attacked abolitionism while opposing class distinctions among white people and the oppression of the white working class. Now, that is the opposite of what we are told. I mean, even as nationalists, that is the opposite of what we are told about slavery. We're told that it attacked the white working class and the people that owned these slaves. They must have been very, very hateful towards whites because they were giving these jobs to Negroes. But that wasn't the way that they saw it, and that wasn't the way that they think. If we take John H. Van Every as an example of what the people that supported slavery were like, they looked at things in a completely different way to how we do today. I mean, we have to remember, whenever we're looking back in the past, we have to imagine what the conditions were like at the time. We cannot just project our society today back then. It's like when people project today's society back into history and say, well, white people never wanted to be Christians, or they were quite happy being pagans. Or, well, they weren't, because Christianity was very different back then than it is today. There was obviously something in Christianity that they thought was good, that they wanted to learn more about. It certainly wasn't about opening all the borders up and worshipping the Jews like it is today. And slavery back then, the way that white people looked at it was not the way that you would think white people look at it today. You would think, well, they would be angry that the white people didn't have jobs and the Negroes did. But this makes it quite clear that wasn't the case. Now, Van Every was born in 1814, and on January the 24th, 1842, he married Sophia Elizabeth Coleman, the niece and ward of Thomas Hunt Rochester, a son of the founder of Rochester, New York. Sophia Coleman Van Every was the eldest child of Anson Coleman and Catherine Kimball Rochester, and Coleman had obtained his medical degree from a Philadelphia medical college and studied for a year in Paris. So this is obviously a very learned man, a very learned man's daughter that he was married to. And during his career, he also studied in Boston, London and Montreal, as well as teaching 2 years at Geneva Medical College. Coleman's personal library contained 148 medical books at his death, and with 426 volumes, it was the largest personal library of the time. So obviously, John H. Van Every had access to that library. He had access to the largest personal library in the world at the time. And that was where he was forming his opinions about Negroes from. Obviously from what he saw around him. But the scientific reports, or as he tries to be as scientific as he can for the time, they would have been based on what was in this library. And none of what was in the library had been politically corrected, of course. Van Evry had one daughter, Catherine Rochester Van Evry. She was born 1843 and she died 1922. After Van Evry's wife died in 1845, his daughter went to live with her mother's guardian, Thomas Hunt Rochester. Catherine never married. According to census records, Catherine listed Ohio as her birthplace and her father's birthplace as either New York or Canada. In a 1949 article, Sidney Kaplan wrote that he received a medical degree somewhere. Whether he practiced it is problematical. Most of his time seems to have been spent as a pseudo-scientific screwball propagandist of Copperheadism in New York. So he did have a degree. John Van Evry did have a medical degree. He also did have access to this library. And obviously by the time you get to 1949, they're trying to run him down a little bit and say, oh, he just received a medical degree somewhere. And it was all pseudo-scientific. But a lot of what he wrote about has been proved correct. Now, Copperheadism, I wondered what Copperheadism is. Apparently, in the 1860s, the Copperheads were a vocal faction of Democrats in the northern United States of the Union who opposed the American Civil War and wanted an immediate peace settlement with the Confederates. So again, this is something interesting. He was supporting the Democrats. He wasn't a Republican. He was a Democrat. He was motivated by social justice, and he saw social justice being blacks working for their food, and the money that was made, and the increases in social welfare that was made through the money made from the blacks working should have been spent on social welfare for the whites. It should have been spent on increased education for working class whites so that they could raise their status in society. And the Negroes would be happy because they would be fed, they would be clothed, they wouldn't be eaten by other Negroes. This is just the way of things. This is the way that it was saw back then. Now, Van Evry believed that blacks were of a separate species from white people and that the boundaries between the races were absolutely impassable. He brought this into line with the Bible's account of humanity's origin by proposing a supernatural imposition at some subsequent period. So what he's saying there is that Negroes had to have been created at a different time. They could not be descended from Adam. So where he says that the boundaries between the races are absolutely impassable, that's been proved correct. There, at no point in history has a white man and a white woman ever given birth to a Negro. It's just not possible. Negroes are a separate species to whites. I mean, even today, they will call them a separate subspecies. The only possible way you can create a Negro is from white people, is if one white interbreeds with one Negro. Obviously, the offspring then is going to be a Negro, but it cannot just have happened gradually. Gradually, the Negro appeared, what with white couples giving birth to brown babies. That's just not possible. And also at this time, he was a very God-fearing man. So this tells us that at this time, this was a common belief. This is what educated people thought, was that Negroes didn't come from Adam. Negroes came from somewhere else. They had to have come from somewhere else. There was a book called Pre-Adamites that was a bestseller at the time, which was suggesting that the Negro was created at some period before Adam, which is what I go along with. I think the Negro was created before Adam. He's obviously been here for hundreds of thousands of years, and the white man's only been here for 7,000 to 10,000 years. If we look at the evidence of people being white, which is civilization, basically, writing, farming, domesticated animals, metalworking, all these things that white people do, that we have done since the earliest skeletons have been found that conform to white people today, which is only about 7,000 to 10,000 years back. Yes, there may well have been bipeds in Europe before then, but they weren't white people. Now, this idea that there were different creations, it was called polygenism. Polygenism is a theory of human origins which posits the view that the human races are of different origins. And this view is opposite to the idea of monogenism, which posits a single origin for humanity. Now, up until a few years back, the evolutionists were saying, oh, we all came out of Africa, we all descended from one monkey in Africa. And that's actually been proved to be wrong now. There were separate origins, even according to the evolutionists. There were separate origins for the different subspecies of humanity. So he's been proved right there as well. Now, he reinterpreted the Old Testament's account of Adam and Eve as a story of the origins of white people. Now, I would say he wasn't reinterpreting it. That was the way that it was interpreted back then. If you were to go back 300 years and say to anybody, were Adam and Eve Europeans, were the people the same as you? They would say, well, of course they were. I mean, they certainly weren't Negroes. They certainly weren't Chinamen. And all you have to do is look back at the paintings, all the religious paintings of the characters from the Bible, to see that we always thought that they were the same as us. We never thought that they were Jews. We never thought they were Negroes, never thought they were Arabs. We always thought that they were white. So he wasn't reinterpreting Genesis to say that it was white people. He was just repeating what everybody else said. And what he was questioning was this idea that blacks somehow could have come from white people, which people don't really appear to have asked. I mean, you wouldn't ask that unless you'd actually come into contact with Negroes, and then you would question it, and you would say, well, where did these Negroes come from then? They obviously, no descendant of Noah ever gave birth to them, so they must have been created at some other point. So he suggested that Negroes had their own separate beginnings. And also around about this time, we had an author called Josiah C. Knott, and he developed his theory of polygenesis in Types of Mankind, where he was saying that these different races were all created at different times. This is what people believed. We started out just believing that everybody was white, especially in Europe, because everybody was white in Europe. And then when we started coming into contact with these other races, when we started colonizing other parts of the world, people started to question this and say, well, where did these races come from? Of course, then the Jews enter the picture, and in their Talmud it says that black people are descended from Canaan. In the Bible, Noah curses Canaan, and the Jews said, well, this curse that Noah made, that turned Canaan black, and all the Negroes are descended from him. And that's not borne out by the Bible at all. There's nothing in the Bible that says that Canaan was turned black. And that's just to the benefit of the Jews, because their origin goes back to Canaan. So they wanted to distract people from that and claim that the Negroes actually came from Canaan. And obviously, at this time, people weren't that aware of just what Jews were like. They weren't aware of the way that they subvert things, especially not in America. I mean, people didn't really start becoming aware of the Jewish role in things until last century, really. So this Josiah C. Knott, he wrote about polygenesis, and there were a lot of other authors. I mean, I can't actually recall the names of them now, but I've read these books from the 18th and from the 19th century. There's one, what's it called? Something about the beast, a man or made in the image of God. That's it, the beast, a man or made in the image of God. There's another one that I can think of as well. I can't actually think of the title. And these were bestsellers. So the idea that the Negro is not a part of the race of Adam, this isn't a new idea. This isn't a Christian identity idea. This was a mainstream American idea up until evolution, the theory of evolution. I think partly the reason for promoting the theory of evolution is so that they can say that we are related to Negroes. So it's absolutely fine to sleep with them because we're all the same species anyway. But back then, the idea of sleeping with a Negro, Van Evry makes it quite clear in his books that someone would rather kill their daughter than have them marry a Negro, or would rather kill themselves than have black grandchildren. That's how strongly people felt about this. And he applied this idea that the Negroes were a different species to us. He'd applied this when he was writing his debate about slavery and Negroes and Negro slavery. And of course, also a lot of the content from Negroes and Negro slavery is reproduced in white supremacy and Negro subordination. And again, this shows you that they took the Bible literally. They really did believe the Bible. These were really God-fearing, Bible-believing, decent American people that were standing up for whites 200 years ago. There had been, in John Every's view, and not that of Knott, not a single creation, but rather multiple creations in different places and of different forms to fit the needs of locality. So what are you saying there? Is that Negroes were created in Africa, where it was very hot, with their black skin, where they weren't going to get burned by the sun, and that Eskimos were obviously created in that area. And he's right in a way, when you think about it. Although all these other races, apart from whites, they're all various different types of mongrels, the mongrelization occurred in the area where they are living. If you look at the Chinese, the Mongol race, there's no evidence of them actually being in China more than about 2,000-3,000 years back. You don't actually find their bodies. In actual fact, the Pamir Plateau, they've got bodies of white Caucasians that go back 4,500 years ago. And then you don't actually start seeing the Chinese race there, the yellow race there, until about 3,000 years back. And this is in the same area. And obviously the Chinese race is a mix of the white people that were there and some kind of aborigine that was there. And also Van Every makes the point that in Africa, there'd been millions and millions of white people there, but there's no white people left there. There were white people in Carthage, in Cyrene, in Libya, in Ethiopia, Kush in Ethiopia. Millions and millions of white people that had lived in Africa, but there's none there now. There was none there in his time, but there were varying different shades of brown, various different types of Negro. And it's the same in India, same even in Australasia. These different types of non-whites that are there are basically varying degrees of mongrel, where whites had mongrelized with them. And he also reinterpreted the Golden Rule through a racial lens, which I think is fantastic. He argued that one need only treat another as one would like to be treated when the other is of the same race as oneself. And that's biblical. Where it says, love thy neighbour as thyself, that is a quote from the Old Testament. And the verse that Jesus is actually quoting there from the Old Testament, it says, it specifically defines who your neighbour is, and it's the children of thy people. And if you actually look at the origins of the word neighbour itself, it means to feed from the same trough, to be close to be genetically close to. Somebody that looks like you is who your neighbour is. So obviously the Golden Rule can only work when it's viewed through a racial lens, and that's exactly the way that it was intended to work. We cannot be turning our cheek to the other cheek to our enemies. We can only be turning our cheek to our own people. We cannot turn it to the enemies of God and the enemies of our people. That's just ridiculous. And if he thought that when he was reinterpreting the Golden Rule like this, he's not reinterpreting the Golden Rule. I think this is the way that white people used to think anyway, the idea that they should give up their own people's well-being to increase the well-being of another race would have been seen as completely mad and not the Golden Rule at all. So if he'd have thought that he was going against Christianity and thinking this, then he wouldn't have done it because he was such a God-fearing man. Human skin colour, in his view, was inevitable and irreversible. the product of a divine plan. Well, that is true. It is irreversible. If somebody's black, they're going to be forever black. It doesn't matter how many white people they interbreed with. The traces of that union, which is against nature, will be there forever. DNA testing proves that. They can DNA test people and they can find Negro DNA in there from generations back. And the reason why they can find that Negro DNA in there is because it hasn't gone. You cannot dilute it to make it disappear. It's just not possible. And he saw this as being the product of a divine plan, that there were these different races. He also believed that this meant that black people were permanently incapable of expressing emotion in the same way as white people. And from this belief that black people could not express emotion, he concluded that they must also be unable to experience emotion to the same degree. Now, this is quite true. What he's talking about there is form and function. When you look at white people, we can blush, we can show shame. In fact, we can show all these emotions just by the blood under our skin, because our skin is translucent. And what he is saying there is, because blacks cannot actually express that emotion, then they clearly cannot feel it. Why would nature give a species an ability to do something if they couldn't actually express that? What would be the point in them having emotions if they were incapable of expressing them? So obviously Negroes don't feel a sense of shame. This is why they were running around naked all the time. They never. And again, you look in the Old Testament, clothes were created for Adam. No clothes were created for the Negro, because the Negro doesn't feel shame. And what we'll actually do when we get into the next episode, we will actually look at some of the direct quotes about this, where he was describing this, because I think he does really well where he's describing the different emotions that white people can display that Negroes can't. And you only have to look at a black actor to realize that they are actually incapable of expressing the same emotions that white people can. He considered that they were insufficiently sensitive to attain civilization. Well, again, that is backed up historically. They've never had a civilization of their own. Arabs have had civilizations in Africa. White people have had civilizations in Africa, but Negroes haven't. By civilization, they were the Arabs. I mean, they've actually had houses. They haven't built mud huts made out of cow dung like the Negroes do. They've actually got old cities in what was formerly Rhodesia, and the Negroes are trying to claim those as actually belonging to them now. The same as the old cities that are there in Ethiopia. They're trying to claim that they were actually built by Negroes, but they quite clearly weren't. They were built by white people. You don't have black architects. No such thing. He believed that black people were bound to remain enslaved. And that's very true. The only reason we don't have it today is because we pay them welfare. And he thought that if they weren't actually enslaved, they would die out, because he never imagined that white people would be so stupid as to pay the Negro for doing nothing. Say, here you are, you can have welfare. And send out all this aid and charity to Africa. It's only because we feed them and we water them and we clothe them and we medicate them that they are around in such numbers. They're not actually capable of producing the resources needed to keep themselves alive for themselves. Think about it. Every day there are adverts on TV asking people to send money so that to help the Negroes find their own water. And what kind of animal doesn't know how to find his own water? The Negro. And this is why John Van Ivry believed that they were meant to be enslaved. That was their natural condition. If they weren't enslaved, they would just be sitting there in the mud, starving, eating one another, not knowing what to do with themselves. And we can see even today, when you look at the Somalians, they just sat there in the dust, in the mud, not knowing what to do with themselves. It's a terrible state that the Negroes are in, but by telling them that they are the same as us, that's the worst possible thing you could do for them. absolutely the worst possible thing. I guess he never could have imagined quite how things would turn out when he was writing this stuff. He also argued that black people's perceived inability to express emotions was proof of their subhuman status. Now, that may seem very contentious today, to say, somebody's subhuman, they're not really human. But he's writing at a time where the humane being actually meant a humane being, somebody that was humane. And Negroes don't show any traits of humanity. They've got no history of justice. They've got no history of charity. They've got no history of mercy. All these traits that you associate with humane actions are not traits that you associate with Negroes. And this inability of theirs to express emotions, to express shame, to express regret, embarrassment, it just shows that they don't think the same way that we do. They have a different status to us. And naturally, that status is one of the master and the slave. That is just the way that it is. If that wasn't so, then they'd have their own civilizations. They wouldn't be needing aid all the time from the West just in order to survive, because that's all they're doing. They're surviving. They're not actually creating a better civilization for themselves over there in Africa. They're just surviving. They're just producing more of themselves. And they just sit there in the mud with their hand out, expecting the white man to feed them without actually giving anything in return. They always used to have to give something in return, which meant that they were actually of benefit to white people, and it meant that white people were of benefit to the blacks, because obviously, like a pet that you look after and you feed. Van Overy also believed that all blacks shared certain uniform physical features. For example, hair colour, nose size, and lip size. Well, that is very true. They do all share those characteristics, whereas these featured were more varied among white people. And again, that's very true when you think about it. There is so much more variety among whites. This nonsense phrase, people of colour, it's really people of one colour. That's all they are, people of one colour. You think of white people, you think of all the different colours that we have. Blonde hair, red hair, ginger hair, chestnut blonde. You think of the eyes that we have, green, blue, honey. All these different colours that we have. And you've just got one colour, brown, various different shades of it, among Negroes and non-whites. And he interpreted this fact that there was less variety among them as evidence of white superiority, which it is. He used evidence from the new field of ethnology to support his belief in white superiority and found evidence for moral superiority and inferiority in racially defined physiognomical features, including black people's cranial manifestation. And that's the cranial measurement, which, as we know, shows that they don't actually have enough space in their skulls to fit the brain the size of a white man. And in order to do this, he quoted statistics published by Samuel George Morton. So he's basing this on scientific fact. He also based this on brain size and hair. And we'll maybe, if we've got time in the series, we'll have a look at actually what he had to say about the Negro's hair. Van Overy was writing at a time which he believed to be the first instance in history in which racial difference and racial superiority and inferiority could be divined from the minutest particle or the single globule of blood. And they're obviously trying to say that this isn't so, but it's very true. The different races have different blood groups. You cannot put the wrong blood group into somebody. And Negroes have different blood groups. They have different organs. You cannot put an organ from a white man into a Negro, or from a Negro into a white man. It's going to be rejected by the recipient of the organ. Their body is going to reject it because it doesn't come from their race. And these mixed race people that have accidents and they require organ donation, sometimes not even the members of their own family can donate an organ that matches up to them because they're on their own. They don't have other people that have the same organs as them. They're mongrels. So what he was saying here is quite true. From the minutest particle or single globule of blood, you can tell that they are of a different race. And we know this from the forensic anthropologists that can tell what race somebody is just from the smallest scrap of bone. So everything that we've come across so far in what he's saying has actually been borne out by modern day science. I mean, this man was a visionary. He really was. But that brings us to the end of today's podcast. We will continue tomorrow with some more about John H. Van Ivry. I hope you found it interesting. Thank you for listening. God bless and hail victory. We'll be right back.